8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. For scientists, communication has always been important. It's been very important for scientists, probably as long as they have been scientists, to be able to exchange information and ideas with one another. Now, today, that's relatively easy with the travel possibilities that people have. And, of course, with a communications tool like the Internet, it's possible for scientists to be in almost instantaneous communication with one another and share their ideas about their work and share data and just talk with each other about what they're doing. Now, in the past, scientists did that as well. They didn't have the Internet, but they used the technology that was available at the time. And in fact, in the 18th, 19th centuries, they used it to great advantage. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an historian who is very interested in natural science and scientists who worked in this area in between the 17th and the 20th centuries. And particularly, she's interested in the work of Charles Darwin and, in fact, has written two very highly acclaimed biographies, or perhaps it's one biography in two volumes of Darwin. The first book entitled Charles Darwin Voyaging, that was published in 1995, and the second, Charles Darwin, The Power of Place, and that was published in 2002. Our guest is Janet Brown. She is a professor in the history of biology at the Wellcome Trust Center for the History of Medicine at University College London. And she is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. And in fact, she will be giving a talk in the Millercom series a little bit later this week on the subject of this correspondence that took place among people who were dealing in the area of natural science, among them Charles Darwin. The title of her talk is Corresponding Naturalists, and she'll be speaking on Thursday, 7:30 in the evening at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana on the U of I campus. And these events, they're always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And here as we talk this morning, We certainly welcome whatever questions, comments people have. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to use. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for inviting me.
I was certainly interested in talking about both of these things, both a little bit about the business of correspondence that you're going to be talking about later this week, and also about Darwin and how those two things come together. And I guess as I started thinking about it, I was thinking of trying to set up this sort of dichotomy, this contrast between scientists today and scientists of Darwin's time. And the first thing I thought of, well, is scientists today, modern communications technology, Internet, this great ability to exchange information. And then I said, well, next to that, what scientists of Darwin's time would have had would have served them fairly well, but would be far inferior by comparison. Well, the more I started thinking about this, and I looked at the Darwin book, I'm not so sure that that was exactly the case. That they had a rather remarkable system, the existing postal system of the time in Britain, and they used it to full advantage.
I'm not so sure about the situation in the States, but certainly in Britain in the middle of the 19th century, the postal system was immensely efficient. It was a very bureaucratic organization and began with Rowland Hill's invention of postage stamps, actually, in 1839, so that by the time Darwin was busy writing and researching and publishing, he could expect to send letters in the morning and get a response in the afternoon. There were 11 collections of the mail a day in London, for sure, perhaps fewer in the countryside. But the way letters were zipping across the country, back and forth, people clearly finding the time to answer letters during the day and send them back in the mail so that there would be a response by the evening, seems to me, exactly like your parallel, it's like the Internet of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, you write that, in fact, as far as Darwin was concerned specifically, that letters, this writing back and forth between Darwin and other scientists, you write, in fact, that this was his primary research tool. Furthermore, after Origin of Species was published, he deliberately used his correspondence to propel his ideas under the public domain, the primary means by which he ensured his book was being read and reviewed. His study inside Down House, where he lived, became an intellectual factory, a center of administration and calculation in which he churned out requests for information and processed answers, kept himself at the leading edge of contemporary science, and ultimately orchestrated a transformation in Victorian thought. Very nice turn of phrase.
Thank you. It's interesting to think of Darwin as a very private man and a very domestic man who liked to be at home. He was never obliged to work in the sense that we now all take employment. He had independent wealth and felt that his home was his place where he worked. His study was where he worked. And that instead of going out and about to meetings of learned societies, going up to London to read library books or to meet friends, he liked to do everything from home. Now, he was a sick man, and perhaps we'll talk about that later, which was one of the reasons that he stayed at home. But I like to think of him as a barnacle, one of those little shelled beasties that stick to rocks. And he had found his rock in his house, and he stuck to it, and he liked to be there. And from that location in his study, he kept himself abreast of modern research simply by writing letters.
It's interesting that the second book, The Power of Place, it's about the second, I guess roughly speaking, it's about the second half of Darwin's life, and particularly concentrates on this period of time where he lived in this particular house for the last about 17 years of his life, something like that.
It's rather longer than that. It's about 40.
Oh, all right. And one of the things I think that you've tried to address is the idea that Darwin was a recluse. And I think the point you're trying to make is, that's really not the case. Yes, he did spend a lot of time in this home, but it's not that he never left, and certainly people came to see him. And with the method that we talked about, he certainly was in constant communication with an awful lot of other people, and that communication was very important for the development of his ideas, the continuing refinement of his ideas, and also the promotion of those ideas.
He had several ways of using his own correspondence, primarily to find things out, but he also never took one person's information at face value, so that he would then check that information by firing off letters to other people to say, Mr. A suggests that such and such is the case, but I'm not so sure. I wonder if you have further information you could help me with. So that it's not just finding one letter and one person who can give him what he needs. He sends out waves of letters to a wide variety of different kinds of people, not just scientists, to pull in the material he needs. And that is his research. But he also has a very strong interest in promoting evolutionary theory. And in that regard, he's not a... I don't think he was a vain man, and I don't think in any way he was seeking fame by doing this, but he felt his theory was true. He really believed his theory was a good theory, that it was a worthwhile theory, and that it was up to him to put it out and about. And he used his letters and his correspondence very materially. It's actually a strategy of writing to the people who ran the review journals, writing to the people who would be likely to review it, writing to his friends saying, do you think Mr. B and C would possibly take a favorable view? So he's really trying to show that his work, to get the best exposure for his work. This is in the 1859, 1860, 1860 mm-hmm. through the 1870s. So he's both being a real scientist by pulling in information and being a strategist by making sure that that theory of his is out there in the places where it needs to be.
Do I have it right that your interest in Darwin really began with the opportunity to read a lot of this correspondence?
Yeah, it's the most wonderful archive you've ever come across. It's a huge archive based in the University of Cambridge in England, where several of Darwin's sons lived after their father had died, so that the materials that were Darwin's were collected up by the sons and given as a bequest to Cambridge University Library. Fantastic size of archive. There are more than 14,000 letters, but also all his books, all his private notebooks, all his proof sheets, the correspondence of his wife and children, and lots of associated visual materials. So as archives go, or as documentary repositories go, it's simply fantastic. And I was an editor for a project that is publishing all Darwin's correspondence.
Mm-hmm. And do I also have it correct that part of the way that you were drawn into Darwin was through the avenue of botany?
I was trained as a scientist, old-fashioned scientist. You don't get them like you get me nowadays. I did an organismic evolutionary biology course as a student, botany, microbiology, fungi, zoology, genetics. And I went into history of science after my first degree. In Britain, as in America, I think it's mostly a discipline that is postgraduate, and I had always had a great admiration for Darwin. Mm-hmm. He's the hero figure for every biologist. Mm-hmm. So I went in to study Darwin from the start.
Yeah. And he and in this part of his life, particularly the part of his life that you write about in Power of Place, his plants doing that kind of work, working with plants at his home, this was very important to him. This is the thing that this was a great passion and the thing that he spent an awful lot of time doing.
He liked plants, and he liked really almost to think of plants as if they were animals, that they were active things, that they metabolized and that they moved if they could, and that they had strategies for survival, so that in his garden and in his greenhouse, and he had a couple of fields in his estate, he worked very hard to try and chart some of the active lives of plants. He was particularly interested in their fertilization processes. So he had in his greenhouse all kinds of experiments going on where he was crossing one kind of primrose with another kind of primrose, counting the seeds to see which was the most fertile union between whichever kind of primrose. He was interested in little garden plants, lithrum, flax, and orchids in particular. Orchids were a very favorite plant of his. The fertilization processes of orchids, the way that insects are involved as well, were extremely interesting to him.
Well, certainly orchids display a sensational variety of form. So if you were interested in the many different kinds of forms a plant could take, that would be a great one to be interested in.
He used orchids, actually, as the very first example of evolution in action after he wrote The Origin of Species and was going through all the controversies after that book was published. He found the study of orchids was both a relaxation and a pleasure, took his mind away from the controversies. But as he worked through their very fascinating variety, he felt that he could really use them as organisms to show evolution in action, that all the beautiful petals showed adaptive radiation, that the way the insects cross-fertilized orchids was an adaptation that for Darwin suggested that design was not an issue, that these were, he could simply show that these were mechanical adaptations to cross-fertilization.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Jana Brown. She's a professor in the history of biology at University College London. She's the author of a 2-volume biography of Charles Darwin, the books Charles Darwin Voyaging and Charles Darwin The Power of Place, the first published in 1995, the second in 2002, and both of those are still in print if you're interested in reading the books. She's interested in biology, natural science from the 17th to the 20th century, and is going to give a talk on the way that scientists at this time, natural scientists, corresponded with one another and how that helped them develop and hone their ideas by being able to simply write letters back and forth, and also exchange material, exchange specimens to write back and forth and say, what do you think about this and what are your ideas on this? She talks about how important that is. We have a little bit here this morning. And the talk will be on Thursday night, 7:30, in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum. It's a MillerCom event, so if you're interested, you can tune in. And otherwise, questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about Darwin's context. I think one of the things that perhaps you gain an appreciation of if you look at Darwin and the ways in which he talked about his ideas with other people who had similar ideas, you gain this appreciation that his ideas, his ideas about evolution, natural selection, didn't come out of nowhere, and that he wasn't the only person to think about this. Can you talk a little bit about the environment out of which he and these ideas come?
It's an issue that's bothered historians for a long time. You know exactly where these ideas come from, but most of us are now pretty confident that through the 19th century, perhaps even through the later half of the 18th century, quite a number of radical free-thinking scientists, natural philosophers, maybe even just philosophers, were beginning to say that events in the human world and events in the natural world were probably similar, that they would probably run according to the same rules, and that perhaps there was change that was not programmed in through a divine force, but change that could take place through the actions of the people or through the animals and plants themselves. So from the 18th century, there was quite a long period of discussion and debate about whether animals and plants could change themselves. And, you know, we've all heard of Lamarck and the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which was a theory that Chip Burckhardt, who we're celebrating at the end of this week, is very famous for having discussed as a historian, that Lamarck proposed that animals and plants had it within themselves. They had an ability inside themselves to change, to progress, to advance. Now, 19th century Europeans, for the most part, rejected that idea. But there were people still saying, well, come on, you know, it looks as if that might be the case. And particularly secular thinkers felt this would be the case. And Darwin was brought up and taught by a large number of figures who were not at all irreligious. They were not atheists. They were very firm believers in the divine works. It was only when he came on to the Beagle Voyage that he began to think similarly, that animals and plants had the ability to change. And when he came back to London after the Beagle Voyage and lived in London through the late 1830s, early 1840s, he began to mix and mingle with a number of people who similarly thought these kinds of things. So exactly as you say, there were figures, not many, we can probably count them, they're probably under 10, known writers who are suggesting these kinds of things. But all historians have to agree that there's probably an undercurrent of thought that we can't map. Those people who didn't write things down, we don't know how to get at what they thought, but we're all pretty confident that there was an undercurrent of thinking that animals and plants and human societies had the ability to change, and that you didn't have to call on God to do this.
We have a couple of callers. Why don't we talk with them? I'll start with someone who was listening this morning over in Indiana, and that is on line 4, toll-free line, right here. Hello. Caller there on, hold on, there we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I said you just started on a track that I'd rather listen to than ask my question, but since I'm on the phone, I'll go ahead and ask it. I was wondering if she can make some general comments about correspondence. Besides the British and British biologist in the large sense corresponding with Darwin and back and forth, correspondence was a fairly well-known tool in the mathematics world. I was wondering if she's done any research at all in that, and if so, if there are any correspondences or general statements that can be made about correspondence in general at that period of time. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I think that may be a little bit outside of your area, but can you respond?
Well, you know, all scientists corresponded, and so I'm my expertise lies in the naturalists, who were particularly hot correspondents, but I would guess mathematicians were just as keen to correspond. I could say something about astronomers, because they were immensely in need of contact with other astronomers in other parts of the world, and one could can find in the archives all over the world big deposits of letters between 19th century figures, early 20th century figures, talking about theories of the stars, and also practical information about observations. So they were using their correspondence both for getting validating observations, but also to throw out theories and to discuss the larger implications of what they might be seeing. And I would be fairly sure mathematicians must have been doing the same.
Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in perhaps having you talk a little bit about Darwin the man, and how he as an individual and who he was shaped what he thought and how he approached the world. For example, one of the things that you talked about was the fact that through a lot of his life, he was plagued by serious illness. And I guess nobody knows exactly what this was about, other than the fact that it was bad, it could be debilitating, and that perhaps also it provided him an excuse for when he didn't want to do something, he could always say that he was not well. But in fact, that he was not well for a lot of his a lot of life, really, after the Beagle.
It's important to acknowledge that he really was not well. There's quite a lot of laughter and jokes about him pretending to be ill so that he didn't have to do lunch with people, and I'm sure that must have been an excuse he used on occasions. But I've been through those materials and through that archive, and he really was ill. It's almost impossible with this big distance between us and him to make guesses as to what it was. There's a very considerable school of thought that whatever he had was, it was, the symptoms are very obviously gastrointestinal. He had very, very poor digestion. There's a lot of thought nowadays that these were probably psychosomatic symptoms, that in some way Darwin's theories and the anxiety about putting those theories in front of the world and the judgments that were being made, the controversies after he put his theories forward, that there was considerable stress, and the stress exacerbated all his symptoms. Now, if we really want to get into it, you know, at the end of his life, he became much better. And so if it's stress, perhaps we have to think through how that affects the body a little more carefully, because from the age of 65 or so, he was pretty damn healthy. The illness was not a lifelong illness.
So you can't explain that by him making some peace with the fact that some people were very angry and very upset with the things that he had written?
Yes, but they continued to be angry and upset. He may have made his peace, or there may have been... You know, I'm a bit of a physicalist. I think that he might have had an ulcer or one of these things that just comes and goes. that was exacerbated incredibly by the anxieties through the 1860s. And that eased off a wee bit in the 1870s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a big issue. People get very angry at meetings, historical meetings, about what did Darwin have. We argue like mad about it.
Yeah. You can tell, obviously, that he was concerned about how his ideas would be received, because he waited a long time before formally coming out in print with those ideas. And perhaps it was only because he was urged because there was another scientist who had a similar kind of set of ideas who was getting ready to go and publish, that perhaps some of his friends said to him, look, you really need to get your ideas out there as well, because someone else is going to likely to be there first. So obviously he was concerned about the impact and how it would be received. He was fortunate that he had some good friends who were champions of his ideas and were willing to go out there literally and, well, maybe not literally, but in a manner of speaking, duke it out with his opponents to defend his theories. It must have, as you say, it must have been very difficult knowing and following very, he apparently followed very closely everything that was written about him, and meticulously clipped newspaper articles and cartoons caricaturing him, and that he knew full well everything that was being said about him.
Mm. He's one of these people that I think is a really good example of a classic scientist. He felt that he should know everything there was to know about the ramifications of his theory. And once he had this brilliant idea in the middle of the 1830s, just after he came back from the Beagle Voyage, instead of publishing it straight away, he was wonderful. I truly admire this. He spent years and years and years making sure it was right. And he made sure it was right in every conceivable area that he could think of. Now, there were one or two areas that he didn't actually think of that he was anxious about. But by the time he had come to start really writing this up for publication, as you say, his friends were beginning to nudge him a bit and say, you know, come on, other people are thinking these things. Mm. Come on, get a move on. And he didn't deliberately delay. I think it was true scientific caution. But one of the major events of his life was when a letter arrived from Alfred Russel Wallace, who he'd been corresponding with out in Malaysia, about natural history specimens. Exactly what his friends had been predicting happened. A letter came in the post, completely unexpected, enclosing an essay that Alfred Russel Wallace said, "Dear Mr. Darwin, I wonder if you'd look this through. It's something I thought of very recently, and I think it explains the question of the origin of species." And Darwin was not expecting this, so all that was a tremendous shock. Mm-hmm. When the caution that he had and research that he had lavished on his theory suddenly appeared to be pulled away from him, that here was another very brilliant thinker who had produced the same theory and written it down in 10 pages, whereas his was 200 pages.
Well, how much longer do you think it would have, if that had not happened, how much longer would it have been before there was The Origin of Species was published?
It wouldn't have ever been The Origin of Species, because that was a new book that he wrote after having received Wallace's letter. There was a book that Darwin was writing that he began 3 years before he received Wallace's letter. That was halfway through, maybe even three-quarters of the way through. It would have been published in the middle of the 1860s, and I've seen the manuscript. Lots of historians have seen the manuscript. I don't think anyone would have read it. It's a big, big, heavy book. It's a real scientific book. Mm-hmm. What Wallace's letter did for Darwin was it fired him up to the extent that he felt he had to write something quick. And he wrote a short book. He didn't put in the footnotes. He didn't put in all the supporting material. I mean, even though Darwin thought it was a short book, it's still quite a long book. But it reads well. It's gripping stuff. It's a quick, beautifully constructed argument presenting his theory, and that's The Origin of Species. That was done in a year after he received Wallace's letter.
So, in fact, the result was a book that was much more accessible, ended up being more widely read, and perhaps touched off a lot more discussion and debate than it would have otherwise if it had been this other book that only scientists would have read.
Yep. So we have Wallace to thank for many things. First of all, he was an extremely brilliant thinker and did propose exactly the same, very nearly the same theory as Darwin. But he galvanized Darwin, too, into producing this book, The Origin of Species. Wallace and Darwin were always close friends afterwards, and there's a very moving moment late in Wallace's life where he sends another letter to Darwin saying that he would never have written a book like The Origin of Species, and the theory would never have had the publicity and the attention and the support if it had only been Wallace writing. Mm-hmm. So he very generously acknowledges that The Origin of Species did something that he couldn't have done.
Well, we have another caller here. We'll get right to. Let me again introduce our guest, Janet Brown. She is a professor. She's the Wellcome Trust professor at the Wellcome Trust Center for History of Medicine at University College London, and she's particularly interested in the history of natural science in the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century. She's the author of a two-volume biography of Charles Darwin. The first was published in 1995, that book, Charles Darwin Voyaging, and the second published in 2002, Charles Darwin, The Power of Place. And she'll be talking about how it is that natural scientists at this time used correspondence to develop their ideas. She'll be giving a talk. It's titled Corresponding Naturalists, Thursday night of this week in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. It's a Millercom event. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. It's free and open to the public. We've been talking this morning about Darwin and also this particular aspect. I like one of the stories that you tell in the book that apparently Darwin was so excited about the mail arriving that he had a mirror set up at his desk. So as he was sitting at his desk, he could see the postman coming up to the house. He looked so forward to going out there and seeing what would arrive. Well, let's talk with the caller here, and the caller is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Mm-hmm. How are you? I don't know if I read your earlier book in 95, but I did read an earlier book in the early 90s about Darwin, more about his personal life, about the death of his daughter and how that affected him. But when you talk about the controversy of evolution, it's interesting that historically there doesn't seem to be any controversy about chemistry abandoning alchemy, nor mathematics abandoning numerology, or the Pythagorean bit where, you know, everybody thought that his theorems were actually like mathematics were out in the ether somewhere, and you pull down the formulas from almost as if like a divine source of knowledge. And it's interesting that because of evolution's direct, relationship to our origins, it seems to be just that's where the controversy originates from.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly so, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, if historians hunt about in the past science, and they can find lots of controversies, and so, sure, there are controversies. They just don't hit the public quite the way that this evolutionary one did.
I mean, Darwin was so ridiculed in his own life. I mean, you were talking about the drawings of him, they try to humiliate him. I mean, basically, what he saw and Wallace saw was a process that's around us all the time, has been with us. I mean, all since 3 billion years ago, or whatever, and they just recognized it, and they're ridiculed because it's so close to home, to use that cliche. But it's interesting that, I mean, when you think of chemistry, like I said earlier, you know, they have alchemists. I mean, even, I'm trying to think of his name, Newton used to think that he created the, Principia Mathematica, then he goes out and starts to try to figure out how to make gold out of lead for the rest of his life. But no one bothers to say that about him. But it's interesting that because it's so close to home, it's our existence in and of itself. It's just, it's so upset so many people, and I'm always puzzled by why people have rejected this form of science for so long. But I don't know. It's just odd to me.
I'm not able really to talk about the modern day, but you know, Darwin himself found some of those cartoons quite funny. He was a very mild-mannered man and very humane and gentle, humble, actually, and collected those things. I guess some of them probably were a bit insulting, but they weren't really vicious like modern cartoons are. These were Victorian caricatures, which for the most part turn him into an ape. They make the connection between Darwin and the theories of human origins, and then they kind of make him look like an ape. And I don't know if you've seen pictures of Darwin in his old age, but he was very hairy.
Oh, yeah.
He had huge beard and big eyebrows. Mm-hmm. And that's a gift for cartoonists, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, in a way, were those drawings after just The Origin of Species, or were they after his book about... I think of The Ascent of Man.
They were after The Descent of Man. Yeah, yes, they were. Man, yes,
yeah.
When the connections could be made much more obvious.
I wonder how many people saw in Origin of Species the connection. I mean, it's a fascinating subject. I mean, really, it is. I mean, your whole period of this time, because it's still gone from us now. But I really appreciate your work. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, was Darwin at all hesitant about going from finches and orchids and talking about natural selection and evolution? Was he at all hesitant about going from there and saying, and as far as human beings are concerned and how they develop, we would have to say that the same process operates? Mm.
He, right from the beginning, he was absolutely committed to human beings being part of the same world as animals and plants. So we have his private notebooks from the very early times where it's categorically clear that human beings are included. Now, he was a cautious man and very early on realized that to talk directly about human origins was going to create controversy, and he systematically kept humans out of his public writings for a long, long time. He thought about them a lot. He made notes about them, private notes, so human beings are considered by him all through his lifetime, but he kept them out of The Origin of Species for very obvious reasons, that it would create a huge controversy. Now, the controversy after the book was exactly about the humans. Where are the humans in this book? Where's God in this book? So the controversy, rather paradoxically, was about things that weren't in The Origin of Species. And eventually, 20 years later, he felt it was an honest thing to write up his own views, which he did in the book called The Descent of Man. And that set off another secondary controversy, because here he was coming right out and saying what he didn't say in The Origin of Species.
Was he a religious man? Was he an unreligious man? Did he think about this clash? Obviously, it existed then as it exists now, this clash between religious values and scientific ideas. Did he, in his personal life, think about that?
His life was a very long one. And like all of us, he went through different stages of belief. Certainly when he was young, he was brought up in a rather free-thinking medical atmosphere. When he went to university, he encountered some extremely upright, virtuous, theological thinkers, believers, people who were priests, who were also teaching in the university, and who he admired and whose values he accepted. So there was a moment in his youth when he was very religious. There's a funny moment even when he and his father discussed perhaps he should go into the church. But the Beagle Voyage intervened, and we are pretty certain as historians that during that voyage he began to feel less and less sure about the existence of there being direct intervention by some divine force in the natural world. He does seem to have believed that there was something divine for quite a long, long time, but he didn't believe this God acted directly in nature. For example, he stopped believing in miracles very early on. Lots of people still believed in miracles in the 19th century, but Darwin rejects them. We think that he probably still believed in some kind of divinity when he wrote The Origin of Species. that gets lost very quickly after that. He never said he was an atheist. He liked the new word that described a lot of what these scientists felt in the latter half of the 19th century. He preferred to use the word agnostic. They don't know. There's no proof. If there was proof, they would accept, but they need to know, and agnostic is being unable to know.
Mm. And as I think a caller mentioned, I think a lot of people have pointed to he had a family, he had a wife, he had a number of children, and lost one daughter. That was a particularly difficult blow for him. Did that make any kind of bridge from that into his work, or was that simply it was his private life and it was very difficult, but that somehow that those two things didn't connect?
Now, his private life was very intimately connected with his work. His wife was a rather religious woman, in the nicest possible way. And the little girl who died, actually there were three children who died. It happened in a lot of 19th century families. But this, there was a stillborn baby, there was a child who lived to about 18 months old who also died 10 years later. But the little girl who died was his first daughter, his second child, who had got through all the childhood illnesses up to the age of 10, and then came down with some awful mysterious fever, which lasted and lasted and lasted, and then poor little thing died. And he was there as she died and was devastated, as any father would be. But because of the work he was doing as well, he immediately connected the two together and said, how can there be a God who would let this happen? This was the most beautiful little girl, healthy, happy, wonderfully generous. How can there be some Christian doctrine that says that she has sinned and she's died? So he was. It had a very big effect on him, yes.
Let's talk with another caller here while we still have time. Someone listening in Charleston, and this is line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. A couple of questions. Were there any communications between Darwin and Karl Marx?
You know, you've hit upon a question that's really bothered historians for ever such a long time, because there's some documentary evidence that might suggest there was. Marx thought highly of Darwin's writings and sent him a copy of Das Kapital, a courtesy copy, quite late in life, in the 1870s. And there's a letter in the archive that seems to look as if it's from Marx saying, I really admire your writings. But, you know, that's been shown now that it's from Edward Aveling, Marx's son-in-law and disciple. So we don't think there's actually any direct contact between them.
And the other question would be, it almost seems logical, or it is logical, that the origin of the species and what Dr. Darwin discovered could, without a lot of stretch, be carried over to the social sciences. Humans, you know, who have the ability to think dialectically, I mean, other animals do too, but to the degree that humans do, and to follow that along based upon the way we are socially organized under capitalism, which is terribly divisive and wasteful, that it occurs to me that one just had to follow the other, and, you know, the Marx and his beginnings, and Darwin and his own, that these things had to coalesce at some point. Do you find that logical?
I can't answer the question about whether it's logical, but I could perhaps reflect on the fact that Darwin's theory emerged out of industrialized Britain. It matches almost word for word, metaphorically, the structure of a capitalist, entrepreneurial, industrialized society. And so it would be very difficult for that kind of theory to become a socialist theory, because natural selection is posited on individual success. It's not a theory that has whole groups of organisms moving in the same direction together. Well, so I'm afraid I can't exactly directly answer your question. I'm sorry.
Just a little follow-up. If what I understand about the surviving species, that they do not, in order to assure the evolution of their own species, consume each other. There are always situations where that can happen, but humans have perfected that. It is just astounding, you know, that the use and abuse of, even in modern times, the third world populations and such as that, that did spring, of course, from the invention of the steam engine and all that came from that. And even over onto the social sciences, and now we have, you know, even H.G. Wells had a great deal of input for that, too. But yeah, that's my opinion, and I guess I should leave it there. So, and thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. When one thinks of Darwin, I think often the phrase that comes to mind is survival of the fittest, which was, in fact, not Darwin's phrase. He borrowed that from someone and inserted it into the work. And the kind of talking about trying to apply these kind of principles to societies. Social Darwinism doesn't come along until long after Darwin, or at least that, as my understanding, that phrase was coined in the 40s, I think, in the 1940s. But to what extent did he apply, or was he favorable toward this idea that some of these same mechanisms that operate on a biological level, you can apply the same kind of thinking to societies of people and the way society operates?
I think he found it perfectly reasonable to assume that human societies were based on their biological characteristics, so that he thought, yes, you could see natural selection acting in the human world. He felt that much of the human world now has lost the ability to respond directly to ecological pressures, that we are civilized, we have cultures that protect the sick, that look after the weak, and that this was a good thing. He's very strongly in favor that these are good things that should continue. And yet we are biological organisms. That was his ultimate thought about human beings. Yes, so there is a very strong sense that Darwin, if he lived today, would be a sociobiologist. Yes, mm-hmm. He would be E.O. Wilson.
One of the things that I learned that I had not known, and perhaps other people did know this about Darwin, is that one of his grandfathers was Josiah Wedgwood of Wedgwood Pottery fame. How did his? I'm interested in you know, maybe thinking about his class background. The family into which he was born, in some sense, did that have some, in some way, shape his direction and how he thought?
It's hard to pinpoint it, but surely that must have been the case. The family background that Darwin grew up in was what you might call the beginnings of the professional middle class in Britain. A new kind of person was emerging in the industrialized community, the factory owner, the man who had wealth that was not based in land but was based in manufacturing goods, for instance. A new professional grouping together with medicine, the law, and manufactories. Darwin grew up in that world. He came from a family that was, in modern terms, rather wealthy, but again, in modern terms, not ostentatious, not likely to become barons or gentry in the British sense. They believed very strongly in progress and reform and representation, but also in using their wealth for good causes. So Darwin had an entirely conventional upper-class upbringing, university, private school. His father actually paid for him to go on the Beagle Voyage. When Darwin was invited to go on the Beagle Voyage, it was not as a member of the British Admiralty, of the Navy. It was an invitation to pay to go round the world. Mm-hmm. And his father did pay for him to do so. And then when he came back, he was expected to earn a living. And he managed to earn a living by writing his books. But there was considerable inherited wealth behind him.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. If you'd like to read more about the life of Charles Darwin, there are two books by our guest that you could look at. Charles Darwin, Voyaging. That's the first volume of her two-volume biography of Darwin. That published in 95. And then in 2002, Charles Darwin, The Power of Place. And they're both still in print. And you can find them, I'm sure, in the library or the bookstore. Our guest, Janet Brown, is professor in the history of biology at the Wellcome Trust Center for the History of Medicine at University College London. And she will also be speaking in the MillerCom series, Corresponding Naturalists, that's the title, about this, the subject we've talked about, how naturalists in the time of Darwin did indeed correspond and help develop their ideas and by sharing ideas. That's Thursday night, 7:30 in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. It's free and open to the public, anyone who would like to attend. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Support for this program comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. The broadcast also made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. That's it for us. Up next, though, is the Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with journalist David Wolman. He's the author of A Left-Hand Turn Around the World. We'll talk about handedness. Are you right-handed or left-handed? That's in the 1 o'clock hour today of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat is trading at 313 and a quarter, up 3 1/4. March, 328 and 3/4, up 3. December corn, 195 and a quarter, up 1/2. March, 209 and 3/4, up 1/4. May, 217 and a half, unchanged. December,